Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
But first this morning, I'm joined in the studio by Jennifer Carroll McNeill, Fine Gael TD for Dunleary and Minister of State with responsibility for EU affairs and defence. You're very welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you for coming in. I want to deal first of all with what's happening here with the defence forces, because we know we had that meeting with the Taoiseach and Minister for Defence Micheál Martin with the Lieutenant General of the Defence Forces, Sean Clancy, yesterday to discuss these 68 cases of members who have been charged with or convicted of public order offences, assault, sexual offences and so on, and including drunk driving. Does the government feel now that you've got to the bottom of that? Because there are reports this morning that there could be very many more than 68.
I have to say, I don't believe that we do yet in a complete way. What we have is 68 cases that are live cases before the courts. So I have to be very careful, because of course they also involve a victim, you know, and there's a vulnerable measure, and they're subject to GDPR as well. So let me be very careful about them. But those are live cases that are in front of the courts at the moment in some way. The Taoiseach has been very clear that he wants anybody who has been charged with sexual assault or rape to be put on local leave, which is a form of leave that the defence forces can use. And we will look at all of those structures to evolve and make that better. But that is his immediate call on that. My concern goes beyond that. And it is that what we don't have, but I believe we will get, is sight of all of the historical convictions that may or may not have occurred, but for the government to be able to say clearly that there either are other cases or there clearly are not. But what I don't want is a situation where somebody has been convicted of a serious offence, a sexual assault, a violent assault, some years ago, say 10 years ago, and that person has since been promoted and that the Defence Forces didn't react at that time. I would like to be able to confidently say that that is not so that
we can be clear. But the Defence Forces would know if someone had been convicted in a civilian court.
So that is my view, that the Defences would and should know, and that they should be able to provide that information very clearly, very accurately and in a very timely way to the government. That would be my reasonable expectation, and I think your reasonable expectation. So a senior counsel has been appointed now to investigate the live cases, the way in which those can be managed. But I also believe that in order to have a very confident statement that it is not so, that there is somebody in that situation, that information should be able to be provided easily. And that is not unreasonable
so
in any way.
That sounds to me that the Lieutenant General couldn't give you that assurance, couldn't give the Taoiseach that assurance yesterday.
I wasn't in that meeting. I want to be very careful around that. But what I'm saying is that my expectation is that we will get to the point. Why is that important? It's important because we have incredible people working in our defence forces. We have people right now serving in uniform around the world, in Lebanon and around Ireland. Those people work incredibly hard and we are so proud of them. So if there is any element that undermines that needs to be found and weeded out, so that everybody else in the Defence Forces can have the pride that they so richly deserve to be in our Defence Forces. The Defence Forces is mentioned in the Constitution. It is a special and exalted place. It's like the judiciary. It's like the police. These are the institutions, the emanations of state that have authority from the state to exert force, to carry weapons, to wear a uniform. They are in a special and different and exalted place within our society, within our polity. And so we must be able to absolutely confidently say that they do not have an element like that. Now, we know that that has not been so. We know from work done by a judge-led investigation that there has been a cultural difficulty in the Defence Forces, and we are working to change that. And there are a series of structures to try to change that. But it is clear that more is going to have to be done in relation to
I'm sure you're aware of what Cathal Berry, the independent TD, said last week, that only politicians can change the law around this, and that law does need to be changed. And he said you're the person who needs to do that. Do you agree with him? Is that on your list of your to-do list?
There are a series of legislative changes being made. There's a memo to Cabinet in relation to the structures in the Defence Forces. Last week I dealt with the Defence Amendment Bill in the Shannon, which is at committee stage this week, to make changes around the Executive Oversight Board and the supervision of the HR changes and the cultural changes that need to happen. There is a series of legislative changes that need to happen. Notwithstanding that, there is a very serious cultural values and ethos change that also needs to happen at the same time. 2 weeks ago, I sat down with women in the Defence Forces in Cahill Brua Barracks, just nice and quietly, but then all of this came out as well, to ask them, quite apart from the issues in the tribunal, what else could we do to make their experience, and let's remember, they're only 7% of the Defence Forces. Mm-hmm. How do we make their working and lived experience within the Defence Forces better? How do we make sure that we're listening to them on differences between the physical differences between men and women? How do we make sure that we're planning their careers having regard to maternity leave? How do we make sure that they are being culturally understood and respected and championed? How do we make changes to make sure that women, I mean, they're only 24% in the Dáil, but only 7% in the Defence Forces. How do we make those cultural changes to make sure that they can say things comfortably, easily and without difficulty?
And what did they say to you about what their experience is like?
A whole range of different practical issues that I can assure you I will be following up and looking forward to meeting them again very soon. There is a Defence Women's Network, which I'm hoping will become even more active so that they have good communication. But all of this sits with women in the Defence Forces, women's experience, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, of the Defence Forces and the cultural change that needs to happen for it to be understood that there's going to be a modern, professional Defence Forces, a place mm-hmm. that's exciting to work, that's valuable to work, that people want to come. And this is important for our recruitment because we have got to recruit more people in the Defence Forces. The opportunities there are incredible. The training is incredible and the salaries are very, very good now at an entry level. You can leave college and go into the Defence Forces at €48,000.
But it's got to be an attractive place to be alongside.
So that's what I want to make sure happens. And that is legislative change partly, but it's values and ethos and respect and dignity and listening in as large part.
In general terms, because I note the Minister for Justice this morning going into Cabinet spoke about an epidemic of these types of crimes, so sexual, domestic violence crimes. She was praising the women who have come forward in recent days. And we have, even over the last 7 days, we've seen so many women come out, waive their right to anonymity because they felt it was worth it to be seen and be heard. What do you think is going on?
What do you mean?
Why do you think so many women have decided to step out from behind that anonymity, stand in front of the court, do an interview and say, I am a victim?
Women are completely sick and tired of being subjected to sexual and gender-based violence. I mean, how many times, Claire, have you and I sat in the studio and talked about it over the last 5 years? How many times have people like Ellen O'Malley Dunlop, how many times have women been shouting about the fact that it's just not acceptable to commit gender-based violence and that women have to go through a court process and get an outcome before they can feel that they can talk about it? That they don't have to hide in their communities from some attacker who's in a GAA club or some attacker who's in a rugby club, that they can have the cultural confidence to say, hold on a second, this is a problem. This has been a problem for this generation, the previous generation, and the generation before that. And we keep talking about it and talking about it, but you have to stand up and say, absolutely not, and absolutely not in our Defence Forces, absolutely not in our Gardaí, and absolutely not anywhere else either. Mm-hmm. Zero tolerance means that. And the Taoiseach has been so strong about this. Helen McEntee has been so strong about this. But it requires women, I mean, it shouldn't have to require women going through a court system and being brave enough to have to come out and call for these changes. If Natasha O'Brien hadn't made the stance that she did, if she'd just gone home, would there be this reaction? Would we know about it in the same way? But the event was serious nonetheless. All of these events should never have happened and we have to be really honest about that.
Yeah, I mean, it could be the case though that this problem is getting worse under this government, or is it that it's more visible now?
I think it's more visible because I think if you look back over history, like when I was in college, did this problem exist? Yes. Did people talk about it? No. Was when my mother was a young woman, did it exist? Yes. Did they talk about it? No. I think we've gotten to a point where people are much more comfortable talking about it. I think COVID was a big part of that. The fact that we were talking about domestic violence in a different way. Yes, the incidence was higher, but also reporting was higher. And we have seen that the zeitgeist changed in relation to zero tolerance, that people were more comfortable to step forward and talk about it. Did it always exist? Yes. Mm-hmm. Are we visibly trying to respond and do something different at every level, including, and most important, relationships and sexual education at schools, to talk about a different way of living as men and women together?
Listen, I want to talk about the EU affairs part of your brief now. We have seen Hungary's Viktor Orban has now, in before the deadline, he has decided that he's going to join and set up this new parliamentary group now on the far right. It'll be called the Patriotic Alliance, Austria in there as well, with the Freedom Party, the former Czech Prime Minister involved too. Does that concern you about how that might influence EU policy, having that additional far-right grouping now?
To be honest, the politics of it concern me more than any sort of grouping. The politics of it are such that we see the retrenchment of rights of LGBTI people in Hungary and a whole range of places. The, for example, last week at the General Affairs Council, we were testing Hungary on their Article 7 compliance, which basically means their rule of law compliance. And in particular, I was testing the Hungarian minister about what they have done to the LGBTI community in Hungary. They have equated it deliberately, in my view, with homosexuality, with paedophilia. And they have banned books, they have created a culture of fear, they have created what they've called a National Sovereignty Office to investigate instances of difficulty, as it were, which basically is a press release function for Viktor Orban and his ministers. So there's no measure of independence whatsoever. The attacks on the judiciary, the undermining of broadcast, the systematic dismantling of a free democratic state, and what that and that is the far right playbook. And now I wake up this morning and you see the result in the Supreme Court case in the United States, giving an executive essentially free power to do anything it likes, immunity. This is extremely concerning in the United States. It's extremely concerning right across Europe. It's concerning in relation to the first round of the results of the French election. These are the politics that we need to resist. And when I talk about the rule of law or democratic freedoms, we're talking about a free press where you can ask me anything you like, where you're free in your job to do that. A judiciary that's going to hold me to account and is going to enforce contracts, that is not going to, you know, where you're not going to develop a sort of a mafia state where friends get contracts and the judiciary look the other way. You're talking about an electoral system that's free and fair and not full of misinformation. You're talking about the basics of democracy.
Now, taking over the presidency of the EU in this moment, while all of this that you've just described is happening, do they belong under the roof of the EU?
Indeed. And we have to look within the EU at the standards that we set for those who are coming in, and the making this and how we are going to handle, how we are currently handling and how we are going to handle established members of the EU who are backsliding on rule of law. Now, we're doing that with Hungary under Article 7. We've managed to withhold different funds from them. We had been doing that with Poland, but thank God Poland, the electorate, decided to stand up and say we're not having this anymore, and they voted in a more moderate government who are rushing back to the centre, rushing back to the EU, rushing back to establishing democratic practices, and I wish them so well with it. But this is a real challenge for the EU, because on the one hand we're asking the countries that would come in the Western Balkans, Ukraine, Moldova, and we've begun those accession talks with Ukraine, Moldova and Montenegro, and meeting certain standards in relation to the rule of law and other standards. Mm-hmm. But how are we going to handle existing members for the future? And that is a real challenge. But it is important that we continue to enlarge, because if we don't bring those countries of the Western Balkans and those countries nearer Russia towards the European values,
they may
and
go
towards
in the other
Europe,
direction.
Well, precisely.
What is the EU saying to Ireland on defence spending? What's the message?
The EU is talking about defence spending more broadly. I mean, look, the reality here is between 1999 and 2021, China and Russia increased their defence spend by 600% and 300%, and the EU increased it by 20%. We now have a war on our continent in relation to this, and the EU is saying that there needs to be a better, more shared effort in relation to defence spend. Now, Ireland will benefit from that. Ireland only spends 0.2% of its GDP on defence, right? We don't have enough people working in our defence forces. We don't have enough equipment for our defence forces. We need to buy hardware. We need to buy equipment. I want the Irish taxpayer to do that in the most cost-effective and efficient way. What does that mean? I want to be able to avail of supply chains that are created by a shared European project and at a cheaper measure. Equivalent, if you will, to a getting COVID vaccines in a more efficient, together, cheaper way. Because whatever you use your hardware for, and we are militarily non-aligned, we still have to be able to defend our sovereign territory. Mm. And we need to spend an awful lot more to be able to do that.
How much? What does that look like in terms of the hard cash that now we are expected to spend going forward on defence?
It's not what we're expected to spend, it's what we want to spend. And we want to increase that, according to the Commission of the Defence Forces. Look at Austria, which is a neutral country. It's spending 3.3 billion euros on defence. Mm-hmm. We spend 1.2. We have a very considerable way both to increase our spend on hardware, equipment.
So you're saying we're not under any pressure from the EU to increase our spending. This is a decision that Ireland and the Irish government is making.
That's absolutely my view. This is a decision that has already been made in terms of expanding our defence forces, giving us the capacity to have better monitoring of our area, better capacity to defend our sovereign territory. We're going to need to spend money to do that. And I would much rather do that in a shared way because of the war in Ukraine. Ukraine. Mm-hmm. It is not an easy thing to get military equipment at the moment. All of that military equipment is being used in Ukraine. So the supply chains are tight to begin with. And then on top of that, you have the prices that go with tight supply chains. We can either be part of a group that is doing this together, or again, outside, you know, on our own in some way. That doesn't serve the Irish people. It doesn't serve the Irish taxpayer.
So benefiting from economies of scale.
Precisely,
is what
and
you're
supply
saying.
Chains.
Because military spending in Central and in Western Europe is higher now than it was in the last year of the Cold War. Is that something we should be concerned about, at where this is all heading?
Well, first of all, prices are very different, do you know what I mean, today than they were at that point. But I think what you need to look at is the difference in spend over the last number of years, and where different countries like Denmark, Estonia have made decisions to increase their spend. Denmark cancelled a public holiday last year in order to try to reach 3% or 3.3% by 2030 instead of 2033. They cancelled a public holiday that they've had since the 17th century, a historical prayer day, so that they could generate 427 million euros towards their defence spend. That's how seriously they're taking increasing our defence spend. Last year, we gave ourselves another public holiday, which is fine, which is grand. You know what I mean? It was there. But that's the difference in terms of thinking in relation to defence spend in Denmark. Estonia, Latvia, Finland, Sweden, everybody is increasing their defence spend because they live in a place where they can see the risk. And I can see that when I speak with my colleagues there, I can see what their focus is. Across Lithuania, there are Russian jets coming in over Lithuania that are having to be, and I use this with finger quotey things, escorted out to test. This is what's happening on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. The scale of the hybrid attacks, the cyber attacks. And Ireland has a very strong interest in that.
This is what Russia wants, though, isn't it? It wants to intimidate. It
yes.
wants countries like Denmark to have to cancel a public holiday. That's all part of Project Fear.
Well, it's not just Project Fear. They invaded Ukraine. You know, they invaded a democratic country in Europe, and they have been very clear about their intentions in relation to that. So it's not just a fear project. This is an active project. The foreign minister in Latvia says, you know, we may never get to a physical war, but we're already at that hybrid war.
Okay.
And Ireland is just as vulnerable to that as anywhere else. And we have to just be real about this.
All right, Minister, we need to leave it there. Thank you very much for coming in. That's Minister Jennifer Carroll McNeill, back after this break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.